Dear brethren, this is Andy Hayward. Doubtless most of you were expecting to be in Revelation this evening, but the other speaker felt he had much less voice than I had tonight, and therefore we're going to swap classes and do Romans this evening, and God willing, enough voice comes back, Revelation next week. Apologise for those who may not have put their Romans notes wrong, because we will be referring to them quite a bit this evening. Anyway, that will give you the opportunity to take your written notes down and do. By way of review, and it's going to be much briefer than was implied, we'll simply put up the transparency that we used last time, particularly to note the way in which, particularly in the Greek text, if you have a diagram that comes out fairly clearly in that, and I notice also in Rotherham's translation that comes out very clearly, that there are certain, if you like, verbs put against, I don't know other. What the grammatical construction would be, but you see here in verses 6 through 9 particularly, these are the things that the apostle tells us. Having gifts differing according to grace, letter, prophesy, minister, teach, exhort, give, rule, show mercy, and love. And these other statements which go next will tell us the way in which we should do those things. We should prophesy according to the analogy of the faith. We should minister by performing that ministry heartily in the faith. We should teach by cultivating the gift so as to influence others in the faith. We should exhort by urging others to the practical duties of the faith. We should give with simplicity, singleness, or liberality. We should rule, that is, lead or preside, with diligence or earnestness. We should show mercy with cheerfulness, and our love should be genuine, unfeigned acts of kindness. Now, at that point, the theme just changes slightly, because the apostle then introduces a statement, which is where we're going to start this evening, in verse 9, having concluded with the statement, let love be without dissimulation. He then makes the statement, abhor that which is evil, and cleave to that which is good. Now, whilst in a moment I'll perhaps obscure some of those, the bottom ones there, so we can take them one at a time, nevertheless, we'd like to have a look then at the structure which goes through from verse 10 through to verse 14. If you happen to have a copy of Rotherham, I was going to get a transparency made up and it slipped my mind, you would find that Rotherham picks it up very much this way. In brotherly love, do certain things. In honour, in duty, in spirit, in hope, in tribulation, in prayer, and then the inward change to just a slight difference here, with the needs of the saints have fellowship, and he simply states the concluding statement, hospitality pursuing. In other words, pursue hospitality. So we're going to this evening consider these particular attributes down here that Paul speaks about: brotherly love, honour, duty, spirit, hope, tribulation, prayer, and the final two. If you do happen to have your notes there, we'll be picking it up from around about page 102. Well, so we can perhaps just focus on the relevant ones as we're looking at them. In fact, in verse 9, and we suggest that this was the break point, he says, let love be without dissimulation. And we looked at that very briefly last time. We really glossed over it because we were running short of time. But it's a very, very important one. The word love there is the word agape. We're going to have a look in a moment at a similar word, which is brotherly love, which is going to be the word philio in a compound form, Philadelphia. But at the moment, this is the word agape, which was the climax of that previous series. And he says there that love is to be without dissimulation. That's not a word that we use every day of the week, is it, dissimulation? But when we look at the Greek word, which is an hypocritus, we can see there that we've got the word hypocrite in there. And that's a word we do know quite well, a hypocrite or a play actor. And when you put the letter A in the front of a Greek word, or if it happens to start with a vowel, they put A-N in front of it just so it flows on smoothly. So when you've got an hypocritus, it means negative hypocrisy. Don't have hypocrisy. So he says, your love must be without hypocrisy. I'd like to look at the quote in James chapter 3, verse 17, where we get this particular expression.
James chapter 3 verse 17, where he's talking about the fruits of true wisdom. And we get the expression then in verse 17 of James 3, but the wisdom that is from above, and he's contrasting the wisdom from above, which is the God-given wisdom, with that which is just natural, that which comes from the flesh. And the point he's going to make, a very, very important point, is there are, it's not the natural attributes we've got to refine. It's not a matter of saying that each one of us has got a natural inclination towards love, therefore we've just got to sort of improve it a bit. That's only an animal love. It comes from beneath. The love that comes down from above has to be based upon a completely new way of thinking. And of course, we've seen that in Romans 12, haven't we? It's not a matter of conforming to this world, it's a matter of transforming. So he says in verse 17 of James 3, but the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, and here is our expression, without hypocrisy. That expression, without hypocrisy, is exactly the same as the expression, without dissimulation. Now really, if we want to be able to love without dissimulation, without hypocrisy, we've really got to go through the procedure that James outlines there. The wisdom must come down from above. It must be first pure. I know that sometimes we talk about, as far as the truth is concerned, it must be first pure, then peaceable. In other words, if you want to have peace, you've got to have purity. If you haven't got purity, then you can expect to fight. But that's sometimes how it's used. And whilst that might be a fact of life, that's not exactly what James is pointing out to us here. And he says, the wisdom that is from above is first pure. And the word pure there means to be without stain, or it is innocent. And it's rather akin to the idea of the singleness. The singleness which we came across in Romans 12 and also in James chapter 1, where it says, you know, if anybody that lacks wisdom, let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally. He gives it to him in singleness because God is totally single. There's no duplicity with God. He's totally spirit. Man might be double-minded, but God's not double-minded. So he says the wisdom that comes down from above is pure in the sense that it's unadulterated. It's totally single. It's totally spirit. So therefore, anything which is developed out of it, which will be peaceableness, gentleness, easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, revised standard version says, without uncertainty, there is no wavering or doubting. So you see, it's again harking back to this idea of the man which is from beneath being double-minded, and it is without hypocrisy. And the RSV translates that as being without insincerity. So this idea that in Romans chapter 12, that love must be without hypocrisy, is really, if we were to put all of this together, and I think we could spend a whole night just studying this one point, what it's really telling us then is that love is the great climax of all of these virtues. Whether we take Paul's dissertation in Romans, where he says there is faith, hope and love, he starts with faith and he ends up with love. And that's what he does in his Corinthians. Whether we go to Peter in the second epistle of Peter, and he starts with faith and he says, add to your faith virtue, and the virtue knowledge, and the knowledge temperance, and temperance patience godliness, godliness brotherly kindness love. And he starts with faith and he ends in love. And of course that, as we know, is really the theme presented in a much more profound way of the book of Romans. It talks about the obedience of faith. And what, after all, is the obedience of faith? Well, we know that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth. There's our faith. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed out of faith unto faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. And how, therefore, would one expect to see faith manifested? What is really the obedience of faith? Well, in one word, it's love. So we're going then from something which starts in the mind, where we learn from the Word those principles of truth, and that causes us to think like God thinks. The single-minded Father on high begets in us a new form of thinking, and it will manifest itself in a love which is not just an animal love refined, But it is a love which is totally without hypocrisy. It is single because it has come down from above. Now that really was the climax of those points which we listed in verses 6 to 9 approximately. And so he says then, we must abhor that which is evil and we must cling to that which is good.
So once again he sets before us a positive and a negative, or more particularly a negative and a positive. Abhor evil and cleave to the good.
The word abhor is quite a powerful word, because it means to detest with horror. To detest with horror. That's very, very strong, isn't it? To detest something with horror is about the strongest way that you could put it. And what we've got to detest with horror is what he styles here evil. Now, evil is one of those words that we've got to look at very closely. Our Alfred Israel students, of course, will tell us, and quite rightly so, that in the Old Testament particularly, and we'll talk Old Testament for the moment, that the words sin and evil are not generally the same. That sin is the cause of evil. Evil is the consequence that God brought upon man because of sin. And so we would quote that passage in Isaiah, who says concerning Yahweh, "Behold, I create evil, and I create good." Or as he says through the minor prophet, "Shall there be evil in the city, and Yahweh has not done it?" So evil then in the Old Testament sense of the term means that which is bad. It can mean bad in a moral sense, so it can in some respects be like sin, but very often it is that which God brings into the world because man sins. So God brings evil in. Therefore it is a God-generated thing. In terms of our Old Testament reason, the Hebrew word means the word ra. Now let's put that to one side for a moment, and we don't want anybody to say, well, all of that's wrong, we've got to forget it, because it's not wrong, it's right in that part of the dissertation. When we come to the New Testament, of course, we're now looking at the Greek language. And in the Greek, there are essentially two words that the New Testament uses, both translated evil. One is the word poneiros, and sometimes it comes across as ho poneiros, ho is the definite article V, so it comes over as the evil one. It doesn't, of course, mean a supernatural devil, but it may personify sin, or it may actually speak of a person who is the evil one. And it really speaks of sin in manifestation. So we say, there is the evil one. Look at that one there. Everything you see about him is the manifestation of the carnal mind. There it is. Sin or evil in manifestation. That's the word poneiros. And we might note that it is the word, in fact, which is used here. It's the only time that it occurs in Romans. And it does mean the evil one. It means sin in manifestation. And that's what we've got to abhor. We've got to abhor everything which reeks of sin. Any manifestation of sin or evil, as it is translated. So I think it's important also to comment on the other word, because we have come across it previously, but I don't know that we've actually said all that much about it. For example, one illustration of it would be found back in Romans 7. And this is the other word, the word kakon, K-A-K-O-N, which occurs 16 times in Romans. Now bear in mind, this is not the word we're looking at in Romans 12, but it is important to put the two of them side by side. In Romans chapter 7 and at verse 21, Paul can say there, "I find then a law that when I would do good, evil is present with me. When I would do good, evil is present with me." Now the word evil in this particular case relates to the evil nature itself. It's not speaking so much about the sinful actions that people might do, but rather what Brother Thomas would style in Alfred Israel, those propensities which are evilly inclined, as he says. In other words, we know that inside of us, if we turn that word to one side, we will automatically degenerate into a form of thinking which is totally self-centered,
and which therefore is evil. We are naturally inclined that way. And so we try to fight that with the Word of God. And of course, we know the argument of Romans 7, don't we? With the mind, I myself serve the law of God, and with the flesh, the law of sin. Now, another way of describing the law of sin is to speak about the evil which is within me, the evil in my members, the inclination which I have to do it the way, to do it the way I want to oppose God. Now, that again becomes another study which is well worth doing. And we're not going to do it at the moment. We're certainly not going to go deeply into these words in Romans as much as there might be some benefit in it. We intend to keep moving. But we would suggest that it's a good study to look at these two words for evil. In John chapter 17, we have a reference, for example, in verse 15, where it says there in the prayer that the Lord offered on behalf of his disciples, I pray not that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from, here is the case where it is, ho poneros, the evil one. And so it signifies sin in its manifestation. Yes, we're going to have to be in the world, and it's going to be all around us. This poneros, if you like, is going to be all around us in manifestation. Everywhere we go, sin will be manifested. And the Lord says, I'm not praying that they should be taken out of it, but that they should be kept from it. Deliver us from the evil one, is what the prayer says in the Lord's Prayer. Ho poneros. Deliver us from the evil one. And of course, we know that the churches at large conveniently pick that up and say that's the devil or the Satan. But it's not. In their sense of the term, it of course is sin in any form of manifestation. So to summarise this, we point out this, that in Romans, generally speaking, the word evil in the 16 occurrences of the word is the word kakon, which speaks about the evil inclinations which are in me, which if left to themselves, will automatically manifest themselves in sin, the evil inclinations which I have. However, the word in this particular case, in chapter 12 and at verse 9 is the word poneros, and it signifies sin or evil in manifestation. So we've got to abhor everything which is of sin. It's not exactly telling us that we've got to abhor ourselves. You know, the kakon is something we've got. It's the carnal inclinations, if you like. And whilst we fight against them, it's part of us, and we've got to try and have the dominion over it through the power of the Word. But when we go out there and we see the world in all its evil, we've got to abhor that. And that's what he's speaking about here, isn't he? Abhor that which is evil and cleave to that which is good. And the expression cleave to that which is good means exactly what it says, to cleave to the things which are good. And we've come across the word good previously in Romans. We come across it in verse 2 of this chapter, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. We spoke about the law being holy, just and good, so we cleave to those things which are of God. And so having then told us that we've got to abhor the evil and cleave to the good, he shows us now in the following set of examples how we've got to act one towards another. Now, it's quite apparently an amazing change in the epistle, isn't it? Because only a couple of classes ago, we were ploughing through fairly heavy dissertations in relationship to Israel's position in regard to the purpose of God. And prior to that, where he was expounding the nature of man and the war that's going on between the spirit and the flesh. And now it becomes so simple and down-to-earth and practical. And yet, really, of course, these words are equally as important as any of the ones that we've studied before, if not more so. And that's why, in fact, we are looking at each one of these words reasonably carefully. So he says, take the first point. In the King James translation, it says in verse 10, be kindly affectionate one to another with brotherly love. That's the whole expression. Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love.
Now, you know it's got Rotherham here, I suppose, because I don't normally carry that one around. But Rotherham says something to this effect, and in fact it may say even exactly this, in brotherly love, be kindly affectionate. So it simply reverses the structure of the sentence. But you'll see the way that Rotherham has set it out. You know how Rotherham tends to index things and then we try to bring out balance, bringing that sort of thing. Well, it lists, Rotherham lists all of these in this particular fashion, and it shows that he is obviously listing off certain attributes. The first one then, he says, is brotherly love, and in brotherly love we are to be kindly affectionate. There's a certain connection between the expression kindly affectionate and brotherly love, because both of them have the word filio built into them. Brotherly love is in fact the one word Philadelphia, and the expression that kindly affectioned is the word philostorgos. And we've got a definition in the notes which says it means to cherish one's kindred, especially parents or children, to be fond of natural relatives, that is, in a spiritual sense, to have a fraternal feeling towards fellow believers. So whilst in the ordinary Greek language you would have the idea of a love towards your relatives, of course in the truth it would be towards brethren and sisters. And the word only occurs in this place. It's the only place where it occurs. So it's telling us then that there has to be filial affection. Now we talk a lot about agape, don't we, being the sort of pinnacle of love. And the idea of self-sacrifice and that sort of thing. The word filio is equally as important, but should never be sort of denigrated into a second-rate category, because it does have the idea of affection associated with it. And there are certain words like philema, which means to kiss. It's got the idea of very much affection. And because I think the church systems at large sort of base all their talks on this affectionate feeling towards each other, we sometimes sort of pull back a little bit from it and say, well, of course, it's not as important as agape. Well, I don't know that we can say that anything's not as important as anything else in the truth. Everything is important. If we're going to leave out any step, then of course we're really destroying the whole principle of the truth, aren't we? It's like saying that if you broke one part of the law of Moses, you broke the whole law. Well, it's like saying if Paul says add to your faith virtue, or Peter says virtue, knowledge, temperance, patience, godliness, brotherly kindness, love. I think I'll leave out patience, that's not quite as important as all the others, and I'll concentrate on the other six. Well, you can't do that sort of thing, because they're all important. And Philadelphia, therefore, is very, very important. Let's pick it up in 1 Peter chapter 1. And at verse 22. First of Peter chapter 1 and verse 22. Seeing ye have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit unto unfeigned love of the brethren. Now, first of all, we've got the word unfeigned. What's the word unfeigned? Anyone know what the word unfeigned is? Yes, it's the same as our word without partiality of James and without dissimulation of Romans. And here it is now unfeigned. So he says it's got to be an unfeigned, unhypocritical Philadelphia. And notice he says that. Seeing you have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit unto an unfeigned love of the brethren, see that you agape one another with a pure heart fervently. Now Paul's putting those both on the same level there, isn't he? He's putting them together. He says you can't really have one without the other. Now let's be realistic about this and perhaps just turn our thoughts inwardly for a moment and say, well, look, we all accept that agape is important and we agape God and we elevate God, but we don't always feel favourably inclined to all of our brethren and sisters. There might be one or two that occasionally irritate me, or something like that. Well, we've got to look inwardly and we say, well, okay, whose fault's that? Oh, it's theirs. Of course it's theirs. But Paul is saying that really this should not be the case. And really we've got to ask, I suppose, why do people at times irritate us or give us some cause to not feel as favourably disposed towards them as we might? Well, we might end up going mad trying to find out what the particular incident was that caused it. The fact is, whatever they did, and however wrong it was, I should be big enough to be able to ride over the top of it. And that's what he's saying here, that true Philadelphia is very much related to Agape. The two go hand in hand. If I really believe that I have sacrificed everything for the truth, as the Lord Jesus Christ sacrificed for us, so we are prepared to give up everything for God, for the Lord Jesus Christ, and for our brethren, and then we've got to be able to rise above those things which cause us at times to feel irritated by our brethren and sisters, or not to show that affection towards them. Now, it's easy to stand up here and talk about it, but in practice, of course, it's not always so easy. What we've got to do is say, well, do I really understand what brotherly love is? And of course, what it really means is that none of us are perfect, and therefore we can't expect anybody else to be perfect. There are plenty of things that I have done to upset other people have done to upset other people, and we accept that, and that's the way it is. So none of us can afford to stand back and say, that person's offended me, or this person hasn't done it the right way, or I can't get on with them on this committee or in that form of work or something or other. We've got to come to grips with it and say, well, look, the fault's in my lap. Regardless of what the other person's done wrong, if we can say, well, the fault's in my lap, I believe that there is a need to see the good in that other person. And of course, the quote in Philippians is an excellent one, isn't it, in this particular respect, in Philippians chapter 2. Where the apostle says in verse 1, if there be therefore any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, that is of agape, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any vows and mercies, fulfill ye my joy that ye be like-minded, having the same love, agape, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind. But I think that's probably one of the main attributes to develop true Philadelphia. A true, genuine lowliness of mind. One authority says it means an unaffected, lowly estimate of oneself. So in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves. And of course, that means that we prefer the person, and we're going to come across that word shortly, I think, a little further down. That's the very next one. So we'll come across this thought very quickly. So he says, look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. So the quote in Peter tells us then that there is very definitely a connection between agape and Philadelphia. Of course, if we just happen to be back in Peter before we go back to Romans, it says, just concluding verse 22 and going on to verse 23, he says, unto unfeigned love of the brethren, see that you love one another with a pure heart fervently, being begotten again, not of corruptible seed, but of incorruptible by the word of God. So it's only the word that can do that for us. As we examine the word, we start to realise, with Paul, how unworthy we are. Therefore, we recognise that we've got a need of God's mercy. We recognise that our brethren and sisters have got a need. Let's therefore attribute the best motives to them. And whatever we think may have been the reason why they did something, if we are at all inclined to attribute a bad motive, then we must back off straight away. Even if there's the chance that we're right, we must not think that way. And I think that's probably the danger in any society, that the attributing of bad motives can be the basis of causing so much trouble. Let's always attribute good motives and If the person did it out of a bad motive, well, they can ask for that in the judgment seat. But in the meantime, we're not going to allow ourselves to become involved in such a thing, and we will continue to esteem them better than ourselves, which, if we're going to see in a minute, doesn't mean to say, well, I believe that person is more righteous than me, but I'm going to prefer them to myself, I'm going to stand back, and I'm going to give preference to them, whatever that might mean in whatever circumstances. And perhaps just one other quote, whilst we're on that one, is in the 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 7, which we've already quoted several times, but we'll actually look it up now. Whereas Peter, in that first chapter of his second epistle, lists off those attributes which go through from faith to agape, picking it up, say, from verse 7, he says, and to godliness we add Philadelphia, brotherly kindness, and to Philadelphia, agape. So those two, therefore, are very, very closely related together. I will stop at the end of each one of these, or at some appropriate time, because I'm sure that others may have, we might call them favourite quotes, if you like, but quotes which maybe can be added to some. Not that we've tried to add, put them all down here, but there are some very good quotes that someone may have one. Anybody got a comment on that? Oh, yes, sorry, I could have stopped earlier. Yes, you can ask a question on either.
I was saying that the definition of the two words, Eros and Tarnos.
Yes.
What came to mind, perhaps, would be one to say that one, Tarnos is more to the temple, whereas Eros is the ancestor.
The what?
Tarnos.
What was the last word you said? I heard the rest of it.
Enacted.
I'll read a note that I've got here in my margin, which compares the two, and see how that compares with what you're saying. It's actually a note on the word paneros. It signifies that which, it literally signifies that which causes pain or hardship. That's what the word paneros means. That which causes pain or hardship. It is sin in its manifestation. Wicked nature in practice. We should contrast the word karkon, which signifies the evil nature itself. Paul defines karkon in Romans chapter 7 and verse 21, which we looked up, and by contrast, poneros in 2 Timothy 4 verse 18, which we didn't look up. So perhaps if we just look that one up, just to complete the note, see what that says. 2 Timothy 4 verse 18, and the Lord shall deliver me from every evil work. Yes, that's a good one. From every evil work. So poneros is the evil work. Whereas the quote in Romans chapter 7 and verse 21, just to remind ourselves of what that one was again, was karkon, where Paul says, I find in a law that when I would do good, karkon is present with me. In other words, the inclination to sin. So that was really what you were saying. So I suppose I could have said yes. But
right. Just another, I think a beautiful phrase in relationship to Abraham earlier is very, very well known, where it's John 16, verse 13.
In John chapter 15 and verse 13, greater agape hath no man of this than that a man lay down his life for his friends.
And the word friend is from the
Is that right? I haven't got that coloured in. So Graham's point there is that in John 15:13, greater agape, and the word certainly occurs extensively through that particular chapter, hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends, and the word friends comes from the root filio. Because he had a different book that says Philemon means kiss, you've got Philemon, the book of Philemon.
Philo, is it?
Philo.
Good, that is a good question, Graham, sister. I think that's particularly good. We shall put that down in our notes for if and when we ever reprint them, I think.
We could add to that you said that it's not right
to stand for ages, but the other, over the place, the self, being the presented, the Father himself, has a filial affection for you. John 16:27, yes. For the Father himself loveth, filioed you, because you have filioed me, and have believed that I came out from God. Yes, yes. Right. Why did you say it's the early part of Romans 5?
Just the whole idea of our worship
and what we
are still receiving the fire. Right. Is that coming? Stuart? It's really the third. When you go back to the first commandment, it's the crux of all of it. When you get to when
what is the greatest commandment here? Love the Lord my God.
Yeah, I'm not bound to the kingdom of God. And I think that's very crucial to that whole structure of what Deuteronomy 4 is talking about.
Yes. In regard to this point of love, you see, I mentioned about filio being denigrated to a sort of a second-rate word, and some might think, well, I don't think that's fair, but I think that does happen at times. I think we almost convince ourselves that it's possible to have agape in a sort of an unemotional way. You know, I can stand up for the truth, I can lead the ecclesia, I can disfellowship all these people because I'm doing it in the spirit of agape. But it can be done in a most cold, ruthless, mechanical, technical sort of way. But it does happen. We've experienced those sort of things over the years with little splinter groups of those sort of things, and I'm sure those people convince themselves that it's being done in a spirit of love, as though agape doesn't involve any sort of affection. Well, even if you can convince yourself that agape doesn't, you certainly can't do that with filio. And if you're going to take, quote, action, which is one of the weird words used at times, against somebody, then do it in the spirit of filio. Good, I don't know that I've ever really checked all the currency through. The concern will deny that, but
no,
it proves that for those who are looking for Bible marking exercises with their family and have run out of ideas or haven't done this one, that certainly the two words for love are a very, very important exercise, aren't they, to go through and colour them in. And with filio, also to add in those compound words, which I suppose the easiest way to do that would be to look it up in Englishman, and anything that starts with P-H-I-L-O-N, that'll do. And whatever comes after it, colour it all in the same colour, because it's almost certainly a compound of the word. And as Graham pointed out, that word friends in John 15 was that one that I hadn't caught up with that in my colouring in. So there's two colouring in exercises, love and evil.
And John is saying before that,
first love, yes. Perhaps just to finish that off in a negative sense, doubtless most of us are aware of it, but there's always one or two who aren't, and for them it's worth it, is that there was a situation in Timothy, Titus, where does it speak about demons? Timothy, 2 Timothy 4 and verse 10. 2 Timothy 4 verse 10, and when we go through and we colour these words in, we'll notice there that it says, "For Demas hath forsaken me, having loved this present world." The word love there is agape. So it wasn't just merely an affection for this present world, but he agape, the present world. So if we get the idea that the word agape always means godly love, then that's not totally the case. But it does beautifully identify godly love. And that's one of the reasons why it is suggested that the word agape has this connotation of sacrifice about it. And of course, God's whole purpose is that he has given his own son to sacrifice for us. Here's someone who's prepared to sacrifice the truth for the world. And the word is agape. I think that would be worth following through. I don't like to comment on things off the cuff unless I've sort of, you know, checked it right through, but it sounds like very good. Maybe Calvin, we could get together and prepare a statement and we can confirm that. All right. I would like to actually move on a little bit. I was hoping to get a little further with one of these tonight. God willing, we want to play. We plan to finish Romans by the end of the year, and I thought these chapters would go very quickly, but well, they're important words, aren't they? And the next one in verse 10, we're back in Romans now, Romans chapter 12. The verse started by saying, "Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love." Then the next statement is, "In honour preferring one another." You see, in the King James Version, it sounds like it's one sentence just going on and on, whereas I said, like Rotherham points out, you've got these series of staccato statements. In brotherly love, be kindly affectionate. In honour, prefer one another. And so the word honour there means to have an esteem. As we were coming on the screen there, let our esteem be such that we prefer one another, or we show deference to the other. The word preferring means to lead the way for others, to show a good example, that is to show deference. Again, this is the only case where the word prefer actually occurs in the New Testament. So that these people were to show mutual respect and honour, not to see who could obtain the most honour, but who could in fact confer the most honour or manifest the most respect, which is rather an interesting definition. 1 Peter chapter 5 verse 5 is the reference that we've noted. We're trying to pick up one good cross-reference for each of these illustrations. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 5. Likewise, ye younger, submit yourselves unto the elder. Yea, all of you be subject one to another, and be clothed with humility, for God resisteth the proud, and giveth grace to the humble. And the idea of the younger submitting to the elder, and the same idea comes out in Ephesians chapter 5, where you've got the principle of submission coming through there, husbands, wives, parents, children, masters, servants. The idea of, as we were saying here in these notes, to show mutual respect and honour, not to see who can obtain the most honour, but who could confer the most or manifest the most respect. And I suppose if we just do go back to Ephesians chapter 5, that the very well-known quotable quote, which I think is credited to Brother John Carter, is a very important one in this respect. But in Ephesians chapter 5, we have that section going from verse 21 through to chapter 6 and verse 9, where we have these three examples of submission, husbands and wives from chapter 5 verse 22 to the end of the chapter, parents and children in chapter 6 verses 1 to 4, and masters and servants verses 5 to 9. Brother Carter makes the comment that each party is reminded not of their rights but of their duties. Each party is reminded not of their rights but of their duties. And this is what Paul's talking about, isn't it? That if we prefer one another, if we give deference to the other person, if we submit, I think the word submit from memory means to place or arrange under. That's what it means. It has the idea of to place oneself under. In other words, if you're putting yourself under, you're pushing the other person up. How often, of course, in the world, do people try to climb the ladder by pushing the other person down? And they feel that if they can discredit somebody, then that automatically pushes them up. It doesn't, of course, at all. But it's not just in the world, that's the flesh. And we do get that anywhere we've got human beings. And that's something we've got to watch, don't we? That sometimes we might feel a little bit insecure or something, or we feel we don't get enough acknowledgement, or whatever it is. And therefore, if we can push a few other people down just by slandering them, then somehow or other that's got to push us up. And if we say, well, all of those brethren over there are no good, well, we've wiped all those off. Chapter, parents and children in chapter 6, verses 1 to 4, and masters and servants, verses 5 to 9. Brother Carter makes the comment that each party is reminded not of their rights but of their duties. Each party is reminded not of their rights but of their duties. And this is what Paul's talking about, isn't it? That if we prefer one another, if we give deference to the other person, if we submit, I think the word submit from memory means to place or arrange under. That's what it means. It has the idea of to place oneself under. In other words, if you're putting yourself under, you're pushing the other person up. How often, of course, in the world, do people try to climb the ladder by pushing the other person down? And they feel that if they can discredit somebody, then that automatically pushes them up. It doesn't, of course, at all. But it's not just in the world, that's the flesh. And we do get that anywhere we've got human beings. And that's something we've got to watch, don't we? That sometimes we might feel a little bit insecure or something, or we feel we don't get enough acknowledgement, or whatever it is, and therefore if we can push a few other people down just by slandering them, then somehow or other that's got to push us up. And if we say, well, all of those brethren over there are no good, well, we've wiped all those off, so that literally only leaves me, so I must be better. And of course that's very, very wrong. Very wrong, but it's a natural characteristic. The scripture tells us the opposite is the case, to prefer or to give deference one to the other. And in practical terms, we are reminded in the scripture not of our rights, which we can demand, but of our duties to each other. Pause. Yes. I haven't got Philippians down against any of the others. Did you want to pick up a... We've quoted it, yes. I've got a note to compare chapter 13, verse 7. Looks like we're going to come across it again in Romans.
due course, Romans chapter 13, verse 7, which says, oh, that's the, yes, that must be it, yep. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honour to whom honour, and it is that word honour or esteem, yes. So chapter 13 is going to be different again. That's going to be our attitude to the world, which is a different aspect of our thinking. We're thinking at the moment of our attitude to each other within the truth. Outdo one another in showing honour. In the quote in Romans, is that?
Yes.
Outdo one another in showing honour. That's quite graphic, isn't it, really? Quite another look in a shop window today to see if they had any NASBs going cheap, but they didn't. I haven't got one yet. Get it? Where do you get second-hand ones? In Lee Street. This was in a cooler place. Completely like NIVs. Living Bibles you can get really cheap, but I suggest they're not a good bargain.
Just to comment on that particular point, I think that
right, and we had it similarly recently in our reading from Matthew with Peter saying, you know, we've followed you all this time, what are we going to get out of it? And he warned him that the first should be last and the last should be first, and just because you were first, Peter, doesn't mean to say you can, you know, you're the best. But here was Peter thinking, well, and then the parable, of course, that followed it about the people who'd been labouring in the vineyard all day and those who came along at the last hour got the same amount of money. And the flesh says, well, that's not fair. Well, it's very fair in God's estimation, but that's how the disciples were reasoning. And of course, I think that's Matthew 20, wasn't it? Was very much directed at Peter. Anyway, it's getting on another subject.
In Matthew 25, he talks about the sheep and the goats being separated. One of the things that separates them is what they've done to at least be brethren. And there's one phrase there where he says, I have not really done this to a certain class of people, the person. And the word there means to be a host or friend. So what they've done is applied the principles of the truth and they brought us convenience.
Yes. Well, that's what he said concerning the Pharisees, you know, you can love them that love you, but it's much more difficult to love people that don't love you. Of course, it's now linking together both of these ideas.
And another
John,
I'll hand
this to
the people
who are
lost.
Is this back on the loved one, is it?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
First
the Thessalonians, because there's Calvin's, the people at the back. Uncle Calvin has a quote in the First Thessalonians chapter 4, which is the one he's been looking for a long time, is that right?
Verse 9.
1 Thessalonians 4 verse 9. But as touching Philadelphia, brotherly love, ye need not that I write unto you, for ye yourselves are taught of God to agape one another. Yeah, it's a good quote, isn't it?
And then it was again in verse 10. And he wants the one who did it was brethren, which surely doesn't talk about Cleo. He deceives them that they increase that.
And indeed ye do it toward all the brethren which are in all Macedonia, but we beseech you, brethren, that ye increase more and more. Right. Thanks, Gal. We've got time for one more. Verse 11. In duty, be not slothful. And the King James says, not slothful in business. Not slothful in business. Now, that to us might sound as though he's suddenly talking about our daily occupation. But really, this section right through here is our relationship one to another in the ecclesia. Chapter 13 will certainly bring to our attention our attitude in the world of business. So, in business, not slothful in business, it will be rendered in duty, be not slothful. And the word slothful means to be tardy or to be indolent. It refers to those who are slow, idle, destitute of promptness of mind or activity. And our quote, Matthew 25:26, brings us to the area that Peter was talking about a moment ago, just a little bit before it, and of course it's in the parable of the talents. And always a very graphic example. I think we could all picture this man. We don't really want to identify with him, but we can picture how he would feel at the judgment seat. The one talent man who hid the Lord's talent in the earth says in verse 25 of Matthew 25, I was afraid, but I went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine. His Lord answered and said unto him, thou wicked and slothful servant. So he was a slothful servant. Thou knewest that I reap where I sowed not, and gather where I have not strawed. And so the master was expecting an increase in his goods. I mean, this is the whole subject of these parables. The parable starts in verse 14. But the nobleman went into a far country and he delivered unto his servants his goods. And he expected an increase in those goods. What were the goods? What are the goods of the parable? Because that's what had to be multiplied. This man hid them in the earth. And he gave back the Lord simply what he'd got. Now he said, look, you knew what I wanted. I expected an increase. Five talent man gave me five talents. The two talent man gave me two talents. Two talents of goods, because a talent is a unit of weight. So there was five talents, five units of weight of goods measured out. What are the goods? And how can those goods be multiplied? And if we don't multiply them, then we're slothful. And if we're slothful, well, then we come under the condemnation of these people in Romans 12, that in our duty, we've been like the one talent man. So follow the reasoning. The one talent man did not cause the master's goods to multiply. Well, what are the master's goods?
The faith.
The faith.
It's demonstration. Our opportunities of service.
Our opportunities of service. In Matthew,
the learning should be.
In Matthew 24, it says, concerning the faithful and the wise servant, verse 46, blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Verily I say unto you that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. So that's the faithful and the wise servant. So he then speaks the parable of the 10 virgins to illustrate the characteristic of wisdom. Then speaks the parable of the talents to illustrate the characteristic of faith. faithfulness. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. Well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. What were the goods that the nobleman who travelled into a far country delivered to his servants, which he expected to be multiplied? Because we've got to multiply them, don't we? Otherwise we're slothful. So what are they?
Well, in chapter 24 there, admonished to take care of the household. And so the promise was to be concerned with the Ephesians. And that's what chapter 25 shows on the
Ephesians. Right. Well, that's very true. How do we care for the Ecclesia?
Give them their meat in due season.
Give them their meat in due season. So when the nobleman went into the far country, what goods did he give to his servants?
The
The kingdom of heaven is as a man travelling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And he gave 5 talents, that's 5 units of measure of goods, to one. To another one he gave 2 talents weight of goods. And to another 1 talent weight of good. And he gave to every man according to his respective capacity, his several ability. So God says, you've got that much ability, I expect from you a return of double what I gave you. But what did he give them when he went into a far country? When he ascended up on high,
gifts.
He gave gifts unto men. What did he give them? Psalm 68 in the first instance, talking about the Levites, but Paul picks it up in Ephesians chapter 4. And he gave
some apostles,
some prophets, some pastors, some evangelists, some teachers for the work of the ministry, for the equipping of the saints, for the edifying of the body of Christ. And we all come in the unity of the faith, of the knowledge of the Son of God, unto a perfect man. Yep. Now, of course, those are people. But what was the one thing all of those people had? In one word. Grace is right too, in Ephesians 4. But God's grace was the basis that, on the basis of God's grace, they had all received the Spirit. And it's this one word, Spirit, which is the important word. All of these other things are sort of expansions of it, but it's the Spirit. And the Spirit in that sense, of course, in the first century, they were called the Spirit gifts, and they enabled people to do miracles and so forth. But the Spirit means that which comes down from above, doesn't it? When he ascended up on high, he gave gifts unto men. The truth which comes down from above is first pure, then peaceable, easy to be treated, and so forth. Now, to simplify, by meaning we're bringing it back just to one topic, what was the goods that the Master handed out? It was really the administration of the things of the Spirit, in whatever form, and all the comments were quite right. Except I wanted to know what is the one thing, though, it is that we're ministering in. What is the one thing that all of those have in common? And that is the things of the Spirit of God. So you see, we could go around after this meeting and say, look, I've got to love people a lot more, and we're going to permanently put a smile on our face, and we're going to, ooze love. But that's not necessarily the Spirit at all. That might be just the flesh trying to do it that way. Oh, I'm not going to be slothful, I'm going to do a lot more. I'm going to give out twice as many pamphlets next time. I'm going to spend twice as much time preparing my Sunday school lessons. All of these sorts of things. Unless it's being motivated by the Spirit and not just by a sort of a Judaistic sort of tendency, then it doesn't mean a thing. And just one second. The man who hid his talent in the earth, of course, he had a negative attitude to God, didn't he? And he says, I was afraid of you because I knew you as a severe man, as a hard man. So he saw God as a God of severity, therefore he was afraid, he was a Judaizer. He says, the best thing for me to do is to hide the talent in the earth, and, no harm can come to it. God says, I'm not worried about harm coming to it. The Spirit can look after itself. I want to see you multiply. We don't have to protect God's Spirit. I mean, the truth isn't something that's got to be protected. The truth's got to be something that's to be proclaimed. Truth doesn't need protecting in that sense of the term. So we've got to be positive and outgoing, and take an example of a man like David, who was up and doing, and when he did things, he did them well. He did them bad, but he wasn't there trying to protect the truth. That's
the only time
he did. No, I won't let him go, Tom. He said it's yours.
Well,
I think the question is, why was the one talent man only given one talent? In verse 15, and I'm reading from various other translations, principally I think the Diaglot and the RSV, he gave the talents on the basis of the people's respective capacities. And I would understand that simply to mean, or several abilities. The first thing we've got to acknowledge is the talent was not the ability. It's very easy to fall into the trap of saying he gave Brother so-and-so five talents, which means God gave him five units of ability. Now, he didn't give him the five units of ability. That was the way he was born, for whatever reason. He was born with a certain amount of ability. God says, because you've got that ability, that capacity, then I'm going to apportion to you five units of weight of goods. And that's the talent. The talent is the responsibility that's been loaded on that person. Now, this person here was a one-talent person, which simply meant that according to their circumstance, their capacity was one talent. Maybe they'd come into the truth late in life. Maybe they had... Well, it could be all sorts of reasons why we've got different capacities. God is simply saying, I simply want that from you, a proportionate increase in respect to the capacity you've got. I'm not expecting... It's all relative to your ability. Now, I don't really think that it goes any further than that, as my understanding of that verse would be.
John, we'll probably go back to the last verse and think on verse 3.
Of which?
Romans 12.
Romans 12, verse 3, yes.
But I think so, because as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith.
That's right, and of course it picks up the point, and I think it was Alan that made the point earlier, that God has given equally to every one of us his grace, which of course is from there and from Ephesians 4 as well.
Quote, John, especially verse 10, as every man has received a gift, even so, when it's been saying one to another, as good stewards of the manifold grace of God.
1 Peter 4, verse 10. Thanks, Graham. Well, we should finish at that. Andrew, you got cut off a moment. Did you wish to have a...
Oh, I actually just said
that. Just that
Alan
was a bit earlier.
Because
Sunday
morning gets your taxes and we don't have to be 25. So it's very interesting.
This is coming Sunday morning. Right, is this an advertisement announcement? Who's doing the next one Sunday morning? I wasn't here last Sunday morning. It was bright, so I didn't hear the announcement. You, Chairman, presiding. Oh, okay. Well, I think perhaps it would be appropriate to leave it at that, and I won't try to summarise it except to say that we will, God willing, in a subsequent class, to review the rest of those attributes.
While the collection is being taken up, we have the announcement from Brother Smith.
Well, we'll complete our service tonight by singing together hymn 23.